From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
This year's hurricane season has been a tough one for many Floridians. With back-to-back storms, some are struggling to recover.
I mean, it's discomforting, but I mean, you kind of get used to the discomfort.
As conspiracy theories and misinformation about the recent hurricanes and the recovery process spread, officials worry about the consequences.
Federal, state, and local officials have said that these false claims can cause confusion and hinder emergency response efforts.
And we'll hear about a battle to extend the voter registration deadline after concerns that Hurricanes Milton and Helene could disenfranchise voters.
There is likely basically tens of thousands of people that probably would have registered had the voter registration deadline been reopened.
I'm Regan McCarthy. This is Capitol Report. Three hurricane landfalls this season have put Floridians in a perpetual state of preparedness and recovery. The latest storm, Hurricane Milton, wasn't quite as bad as some feared, but as Adrian Andrews reports, this year's hurricane season has already taken a toll.
Hundreds of Floridians, like Bill Short, fled their homes to get far away from Milton as possible.
I mean, it's discomforting, but I mean, you kind of get used to the discomfort.
Short spoke with WFSU ahead of Milton's landfall. The News Service of Florida found Randy Kellstrom and his wife at a hotel room in Mobile, Alabama.
There's no telling with this thing. It's a monster. And I feel sorry for anybody who didn't get out, who decided to stay. If you decided to stay, man, it's going to be hell.
The Kellstroms are from St. Petersburg. A weariness is settling in Florida after three storms have hit the state so far this year. Debbie in August, Helene last month, and now Milton. The Category 3 storm made landfall Wednesday near Siesta Key with 120-mile-per-hour winds and a storm surge that even larger cities couldn't withstand. Governor Ron DeSantis said during his storm update that the state sustained significant damage, but says Milton was, quote, not the worst-case scenario.
Honestly, for the mobile home stuff, I thought there would be more just by doing our tour with like Siesta Key. I mean, our buildings that were built, you know, in the last 20, 30 years, I mean, they did very well. They look good.
The governor noted that at least 300 people and 50 pets have been rescued since Milton made landfall. That figure includes Trooper, the abandoned dog found tied to a fence along Interstate 75. He's now at the Leon County Humane Society. However, Milton and its associated tornadoes have also led to at least a dozen deaths so far.
Mom!
Cell phone videos taken from Milton storm victims show large tornadoes sweeping across different parts of the state. One video showed multiple tornadoes forming alongside I-75 in Broward County. Another video shows a massive tornado approaching what appears to be a Fort Pierce subdivision.
Come right here. You can see it going through the cane field.
On the day of the storm, the National Weather Service confirmed Florida had 126 tornado warnings, shattering the state's record for the most warnings in a single day and the second most of any state in the U.S. As for Milton evacuees, Bill Short and his wife Elizabeth, along with their two young kids, will be traveling back to Tampa from Tallahassee, where they hope to find their house unscathed.
I don't know that our house is technically going anywhere, but you don't know. I grew up in the Midwest, so I mean, I'm familiar with what tornadoes can do, and that probably the spinoff tornadoes and the wind probably scares me more than the water because we're well out of the flood zone.
Hurricane season doesn't officially end until November 30th, and people are watching the Gulf and the Caribbean with weary eyes. I'm Adrian Andrews.
As Florida and America's southeast work to recover following two devastating hurricanes that crashed onto the coast within the span of about 2 weeks, conspiracy theories and misinformation about the origin of the storms have gone viral on social media. Tristan Wood reports elected officials and experts fear that spread is hurting emergency response efforts.
The conspiracy theories have a major theme, that the disasters are power grabs by the government. Sarah Swan, a staff writer with PolitiFact, has been working to debunk those false claims.
So PolitiFact has seen two major false narratives. One is that Hurricane Helene and Hurricane Milton were created through weather modification or otherwise planned. The other is that FEMA, which is the Federal Emergency Management Agency, their disaster assistance is not as it appears. Some viral social media posts have claimed that $750 payments from FEMA are loans that need to be paid back.
The payments to eligible individuals do not need to be paid back and are a minimum of $750. As for the weather, it is possible for individual clouds to be manipulated and rainfall to be induced. But Jeff Chanton, a Florida State University oceanologist and climatologist, says the technology to influence the climate of an entire region does not exist, and there are no tools that allow the government or anyone else to generate a Category 5 hurricane.
If we could control the weather here in Florida, it would be 78 degrees every day and sunny. And so I wish we could control the weather, but you know, we're not even close to that. We can't even think about that. It's just insane to be spreading that rumor.
But that spread of misinformation isn't new. PolitiFact Swan says those narratives pop up during most natural disasters. This time, she believes the widespread damage of these storms has made the conspiracies spread wider.
We've seen known misinformers like Alex Jones and Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene both kind of spread these claims that the hurricanes were a result of weather modification or that the government is controlling the weather somehow.
The misinformation has also led to a misunderstanding on how emergency response efforts work. False social media posts are spreading the idea that the federal government comes into a local disaster area and takes over. But as U.S. Department of Defense spokesperson Sabrina Singh says, the truth is that local and state governments take the lead.
The state knows best what it needs for its communities. They ultimately have, you know, quite literally the maps of their entire communities, cities, and towns. So when there is a response needed from the federal government, or in this case, when you need active duty personnel to flow into a situation, we flow in under the state.
The spread of misinformation has led to strong rebukes from several government officials, including Governor Ron DeSantis. He believes people spreading the misinformation are doing so for personal gain.
Be careful about the nonsense that gets circulated, and just know that the more titillating it is, the more likely somebody is making money off of it, and they don't really give a damn about the well-being and safety of the people that are actually in the eye of this storm. It's all just trying to monetize what they're doing.
And it's not harmless fun, says Swan. The reporter says misinformation can lead to people being fearful of those who are trying to help them.
Federal, state, and local officials have said that these false claims can cause confusion and hinder emergency response efforts. And people living in areas affected by these disasters may be discouraged from seeking help because of this misinformation.
Members of the public can submit questions about disaster response rumors and read debunkings of those common conspiracies on FEMA's website. I'm Tristan Wood.
Amid two damaging hurricanes and ongoing recovery looms a major deadline, November 5th, Election Day. That's when millions of Floridians will cast their votes. But many are facing uncertainty due to storm damage. As Margie Menzel reports, a clash has been brewing over how to best accommodate displaced voters and those in difficulty due to the storms.
October 7th was the last day to register to vote in the November election. That's about a week after Hurricane Helene devastated communities in the Big Bend and just 2 days before Milton slammed into heavily populated Central Florida. Several voter and civil rights groups called on Governor Ron DeSantis to extend the state's voter registration deadline, but he didn't.
People can register today, and then that's that. There's nothing inhibiting you registering today. The storm has not hit yet. Now, after the storm, we will see what damage is there, and if I have to do a similar executive order that I did in Ian and that I did for Helene, we're happy to do it, but we're not going to change any registration deadline. You can register today, and there doesn't need to, there's no reason to open that up.
DeSantis did make other accommodations. He's given supervisors flexibility in terms of when and where they place early voting sites. He suspended a state requirement that mail-in ballots be made in signed writing when sent to an address other than the one on file, an important consideration when voters are displaced. He did other things, too. But Brad Ashwell, Florida State Director of All Voting is Local, says it's not enough.
The governor does deserve some credit for issuing executive order and giving the supervisors some flexibility. We're really happy he did that, but it doesn't go far enough.
All Voting is Local and other groups pushed for an extension of the registration deadline. Some brought a lawsuit. Yet following an emergency hearing, U.S. District Judge Robert Hinkle denied the motion. In his ruling, he said there was no evidence anyone had been unable to vote due to the storms. Metletha Bennett represents the Southern Poverty Law Center and two other groups that brought the lawsuit.
There is absolutely harm. Even the judge admitted that he can guarantee there is likely tens of thousands of people that probably would have registered had the voter registration deadline been reopened. So the impact is there, and I don't think there's a dispute on that.
What I say to folks that did not get registered prior to is I am sorry, but we have something on the front wall out here that every county office has, and that is a thing called voter responsibilities.
Wakulla Elections Supervisor Joe Morgan agrees with the governor and with Hinkle's ruling.
And at some point, the voter has to take responsibility for whether or not they're registered to vote or not.
Morgan also points out that supervisors of election don't get deadline extensions.
Guess what day the election's on this year? It's on November the 5th. What happens if a storm comes in on November the 4th? We don't get to wait until November the 7th or November the 15th to cast that election. We have to conduct that election on November the 5th.
Wakulla County wasn't seriously damaged by either hurricane, and Morgan is grateful. He's been participating in local drives to help neighboring Taylor County, which saw communities like Keaton Beach utterly destroyed by Hurricane Helene. Many voters there don't have homes, let alone mailboxes to receive their ballots.
And you see these people that have just lost everything. They've literally just lost everything. And you still hear some of them say, I just want to make sure I cast my ballot. That's emotional.
DeSantis has said he'll consider additional voting accommodations once the state has made a fuller assessment of the damage from Hurricane Milton. All Voting is Local's Ashwell points to election changes in Bay County in 2018, following Hurricane Michael, as an example of other things the state could do to help voters.
They could extend early voting hours from the mandatory 8 hours a day to 12 hours a day. They could allow early voting through election day. We really need a comprehensive response here. You know, when we're looking at two back-to-back storms at this scale.
Ashwell also says the governor's changes should be posted on all supervisors of election websites, state websites, and floridadisaster.org, places voters might look for information.
It's very unfortunate that he decided not to extend the voter registration deadline, and it's hard not to look at that decision as a continuation of ongoing efforts to discourage, undermine, and shut down voter registration efforts, namely by community organizations who were calling on him to extend that deadline.
I'm Margie Menzel.
Still to come on Capitol Report. After a storm, one of the primary concerns is often how quickly the electricity will be restored. That answer starts with the transmission lines.
The transmission lines have to get brought up first so that we can bring the power in to the substations.
As severe weather becomes more common in the state and across the country, Floridians are looking for guidance.
The past is not a good predictor anymore of what's going to happen in the future.
And we'll hear how one community is working to remove barriers to accessing mental health care. The Sunshine State is getting walloped by storms this hurricane season. On the Deeper Dive with Dara Kam podcast, Florida Municipal Electric Association Executive Director Amy Zubily talked about how city-owned electric companies prep for and respond to catastrophic storms. Here's an excerpt.
So as soon as a storm is cleared out of an area and crews can begin assessing the damage, the first priority is to restore transmission. The transmission are those big, tall, high wires that go from the power plants into those substations. And so they bring the power down to the substation. So if our transmission lines are down, that means we can't deliver the power into an area. The transmission lines have to get brought up first so that we can bring the power in to the substations. And substations are also critical. They transfer the power from the high voltage down to the distribution lines that would feed your house. So those critical infrastructure facilities are going to be first, because if we don't have those restored, we can't deliver power to anybody else.
Got it.
Once we get our transmission and substations up and we're starting to look at our customer base, both households and businesses and industries, our first priority is going to be hospitals and other emergency responders.
Mm-hmm.
And so TMH and the Tallahassee Memorial Regional, those are going to be our very first ones. Other critical infrastructure, critical areas and first responders, police and fire, those areas are deemed priorities. Cell towers, if we need power to cell towers or other state emergency operations center, those are going to be high on the priority list. And so those will get restored first. Once we have all of those high priority locations, like first responders, medical facilities, places like that, we will begin restoring power to areas that we can bring the most amount of customers on first.
So density.
Yeah, so if we have a neighborhood that has 3,000 customers within a circuit and one that has 100 customers, we're going to do the one that has 3,000 on before we get to that one with 100 customers. Mm-hmm. And so when you get to the end of a restoration, you're looking at areas that live in more rural areas or more remote areas, on, you know, side streets that maybe there's only four or five houses on. And those take a while because you are looking at fewer customers and a lot of poles and wires to get that restoration done.
You want to prioritize getting as many people back online as possible first.
Our electric utilities in Florida across the board just do outstanding work. And every power pole that's replaced is a hardened power pole.
Is it? See, I was going to ask, because I was asking the linemen when they were doing that. I'm like, you're doing this now? There's a storm, this massive storm, you know, coming in a day or two. And they said, well, maybe this should help you keep you from getting your power out. And I was quite skeptical, Amy. I have to confess that I was very skeptical. And I mean, we flickered twice. I don't know. Was it the new power poles? Maybe.
Across the state, all electric utilities have hardened their systems, meaning they do regular pole inspections. And as they see wood rot or aging poles, they're replaced out with stronger poles, either with concrete poles, ductile iron, or a stronger wood pole. And every pole that's replaced is hardened.
That was Florida Municipal Electric Association Executive Director Amy Zubily on the Deeper Dive with Dara Kam podcast, a product of the News Service of Florida. Hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has announced it plans to launch a national climate service. The service will provide forecast conditions linked to climate change that can make floods, heat waves, and hurricanes even more dangerous. WLRN's Jenny Stiletovich reports.
Like the National Weather Service, the new forecasts are aimed at giving planners and emergency management officials and the public hyperlocal information.
The idea is basically the same.
Ben Kurtman is an atmospheric scientist at the University of Miami Rosenstiel School, which will receive up to $5.8 million to figure out how to set up the service. Kurtman was named as a lead investigator on the project.
We have a city manager in North Platte, Nebraska, and he's got $10 million to deal with climate mitigation. He needs some advice on what problems he should worry about and how he's going to spend that money.
And in this hypothetical, he'd ideally use the forecast to decide how to spend it. Kurtman specializes in shorter climate forecasts. He says today's seasonal forecasts often rely on past weather patterns and that climate projections, like the rise in sea level or frequency of heat waves, are often too long range.
The past is not a good predictor anymore of what's going to happen in the future. And so they need to figure out how to do the forward problem. How often are we going to have this three-day event in Miami-Dade where 2 feet of rain falls? One day is probably not a big deal. The second day, it's getting to be a big problem. Airports closing. Third day is a disaster.
That kind of information can convey how urgently infrastructure or other fixes needed to adapt are necessary.
Life-threatening conditions in Florida at this hour. A flash flood emergency after torrential rains. Several inches already.
Well, hundreds of thousands of South Floridians could be impacted by rising sea levels. And
the South and Southwest have been baking for days, and now the so-called heat dome is moving east,
where even small changes can cause big problems. Here's Kurtman again.
State funding cycles, local government funding cycles are really short, right? 2 years at best. If you tell them there's a problem that's 10 years out, oh, well, that's 10 years out. I'm going to pass on that one. But if we're telling them, look, this event we just had, it's going to start to, you know, happen more and more next year and the year after that. And that's going to get them to realize, okay, we need to start thinking about this now. We can't just wait for that 10-year projection to come true.
To get the forecast, Kurtman and other scientists will have to figure out how to sort through the piles of climate data to make it specific to a time and place, which is harder than it sounds.
Figuring out how to constrain the huge amount of climate information into something that's digestible, scientifically robust, tested. How do we eliminate the bad models? How do we identify that our techniques for making it hyperlocal don't introduce new uncertainties that we haven't quantified? All that kind of stuff, that's where we're focusing in.
Someday, he hopes those forecasts will become as routine as a nightly weather report, so we're no longer caught off guard by sudden flash flooding when it rains, or heat domes driving up temperatures to dangerous highs, or sea level that can, among other things, make hurricane storm surges far worse. I'm Jenny Stiletovich in Miami.
President Joe Biden will make his way to Florida Sunday to see damage from Hurricane Milton. An advisory about the trip did not provide details about where Biden will go. The trip comes after he traveled to Taylor County earlier this month to see damage from Hurricane Helene. Meanwhile, insurance claims have started quickly pouring in after Hurricane Milton made landfall Wednesday night in Sarasota County as a powerful Category 3 storm, causing widespread damage across the state. Data posted on the Office of Insurance Regulation website showed that nearly 2,000 claims had been filed as of Thursday. The majority are for damage to residential property. Other types of claims included damage to such things as cars. Estimated insured losses total more than $21 million. The number of Milton claims and estimated insured losses are expected to soar in the coming days and weeks. As of Thursday, more than 114,000 claims had been filed in Florida from Hurricane Helene, with estimated insured losses of nearly $1.2 billion, according to state data. Helene made landfall September 26th in Taylor County. It also caused extensive damage to communities as it moved up the Gulf of Mexico and across North Florida. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Regan McCarthy. Finally this week, the dream of opening the Miami Center for Mental Health and Recovery has been years in the making. The building will offer housing to those with severe mental health conditions for up to a year as they receive treatment. It will be open for outpatient as well as inpatient care. Miami-Dade Administrative Judge Steve Leifman has been leading the effort to build the facility, which is expected to open within a few months. WLRN's Danny Rivero spoke with the judge about his work to get these patients treatment instead of jail time.
The timing for when this building is getting ready to open its doors and start letting people in and start housing people ultimately coincides with the state law going into effect that bans sleeping in the public across the whole state. Do you see this facility, once it opens, as helping deal with the impact of that state law.
Yeah, it's amazing how visionary we were when we built this, having no idea that this law would come into place. So yes, I think this will be part of the solution. It is not the solution. And I think by having this facility, we add a new component and capacity that was not there before that clearly will be one of the major factors in helping keep the county out of trouble by not, you know, complying with that law.
When this facility is fully open, how many beds or units for people experiencing mental health problems are going to be available for people?
There's 208 beds. Our guess is we'll probably see anywhere from 7,000 to 9,000 people a year and maybe admit half of that. That is quite significant. We only have about, on any given day, 1,000, 1,200 people living on the street in Dade County, and the majority of them, many of them, would qualify for coming in here. We get a list every single day from the county on who is in a mental health cell, which means they have a higher acuity of mental illness, because in jail, you still may have a mental illness, but you're stable and you're in general population. So if you're in a mental health cell, you have a higher acuity. So we get a list every day of who are in those cells and their charge. And the computer printout tells us who exactly is eligible based on them having a serious mental illness and their charge for diversion into treatment. And we looked at the last 5 years of everybody that came through there. There were about 16,000 people arrested 32,000 times. And over the last 5 years, these 16,000 people spent 1.2 million days in the Dade County Jail at a cost of about $414 million. It's outrageous. It is a fraction of that cost to operate this building, not even close. Look, Dade County right now has about 4,200, 4,400 people in the jail, of which 3,500 to 3,700 have been diagnosed with a mental illness. We, if we do our job right over time, should be able to significantly reduce that jail audit, maybe by another half.
For the core group that's in jail cells now that you've identified as people who would be likely to be the first users of this facility that we're sitting in, do we have an idea how many of those people are experiencing homelessness or have in the past?
Yes. In fact, in the study we just did, it was almost all of them. Almost every single one of them has been identified as being homeless. So the numbers were pretty stunning, not surprising. But yes, they're almost all homeless.
That was Miami-Dade Administrative Judge Steve Lifeman talking with WLRN's Danny Rivero about a new mental health and recovery center opening soon. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Gina Jordan, Margie Menzel, Tristan Wood, and Lynn Hatter. Thanks also to Dara Kam, Jenny Stiletovich, Danny Rivero, and other public radio reporters around the state. Technical assistance for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Regan McCarthy. Join us next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.